I'm Nina Boutsakaris. I work as the archivist here upstairs, which is a work-in-progress special collections library and archive. Jeffrey and I, the executive director of Flowchart Foundation, are tirelessly working to make functional and open to the public eventually. So just to give you some quick context, this is a little bit of the description of our exhibit. In an Ashbery poem, much is brought together, but nothing looks out of place. The abrasive intrusions of the outside world, that's a quote he has said, were not by any means always detrimental to the act of writing. This exhibit endeavors to express, through a small sampling of the many archival and library materials available in our Ashbery Resource Center, the collage effect of the myriad of influences and creative outcomes that shaped Ashbery's iconic style and sensibility as a poet, artist, critic, and translator, from film, theater, and painting to music, architecture, and domestic spaces. As well, we aim to show the shape of Ashbery's influences, how it mimics his penchant for collage in his work. So as you go around and look at the different cases and what's on the wall, you'll start to see how everything comes together in this very Ashbery way. The exhibit takes inspiration from John Ashbery, a comprehensive bibliography written by Ashbery's husband and bibliographer, David Cremani, who we're lucky enough to have with us here today. And it was published in 1976 and lists everything that Ashbery had ever written at the time, down to the smallest pamphlet, including all of his published remarks, appearances on film, settings of his poetry to music, portraits painted of him, artworks that incorporated his poem, and mentions of him in poems by others. And it was the first scholarly work to express the phenomenon of Ashbery's kaleidoscopic fecundity. It is my pleasure to introduce our special guest today to help bring a little more context to this show, all of whom are trustees of the Flowchart Foundation, which is the space that you're in today. Dara Barwa-Dixon is a poet who's been on the Flowchart board since 1998. Her 13 books include In the Still of the Night, You Good Thing, and Reverse Rapture, which was awarded the Poetry Center and American Poetry Archives Book Award in 2006. She's received fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Massachusetts Cultural Council and Lannan Foundation Fellowship. And her poems are included in Push Park Prize, Best American Poetry Anthologies. She's a member of the University of Massachusetts Amherst Poetry Faculty, director and co-founder of Juniper Initiative for Literary Arts and Action and the Juniper Summer Institute and Workshops, editor and publisher of Factory Hollow Press, and publisher of the literary journal Jubilab. And Eugene Ritchie is next to me. He's also a poet who's been on the Flowchart board since 1998, and he's the director of creative writing at the Pace University English Department. He's published 5 collections of poems and 3 books of translations, as well as articles and reviews on translation on the work of various poets, including John Ashbery. He's edited Ashbery's Selected Prose, and his wife, Roseanne Wasserman, who's here today with us in the audience. They edited Ashbery's Collected French Translations, a London Book Society recommended translation finalist for the Poetry Foundation Pegasus Award for Poetry Criticism. And David Cremani is the author of John Ashbery, Comprehensive Bibliography, and he was John's husband for 40 years, I think. Is that right? 40? And along with Dara, James Tate, and John Ashbery, David was a founding member of Flowchart, helping to develop the Ashbery Resource Center, which we have upstairs, and its online catalog as a continuation of the earlier bibliography, as well as the created spaces concept, which we're going to talk about today. He managed Ashbery's business affairs for many years, and he's the executor of the Ashbery Estate. Thank you all so much for being here to talk with me. I just want to get things started by giving us a little bit of background on how you all met each other, how John came into your lives, how you ended up here, basically. Whoever wants to go ahead, yeah.
Go ahead.
Yes, I can start since I met David and John at the very same time. I was coming back from Saratoga, where I'd been visiting the novelist Jaime Manrique, and I was with Bill Sullivan, and he said, hey, let's get off the train and call John and see if we can go up and see him. I said, well, that sounds great. So I got into Hudson with him, and he made a call, and David answered the phone, and he checked with John. He said, sure, yeah, come on up. And so we walked up to the house at West Court Street and went inside and had a great talk. David showed us a lot of the house at the time. And he got us back to the train so we could catch the two-hour later train back to New York. So that's where I met them. And
You've never met them before. He just welcomed you into his house?
Well, he knew the artist very well.
Yeah.
And that's a good story. I tell that quickly. In 1975, a good friend of my wife and Roseanne and mine and me, Billy St. Clair, went from Columbia, where we were studying poetry for MFAs, to Brooklyn, where John was teaching. And he said he loved it so much, he said, you have to come over with me to Brooklyn and sit in the class and see this guy. This Ashbery is amazing. So I said, sure. So I was all dressed up in a bar mitzvah suit that I had gotten from my brother-in-law and a tie because I was teaching that day. And I went to the class and listened to him with his wonderful, you know, feedback on the students' poems. And then afterwards, we took the subway back into Manhattan, and I told him, he asked me what I was doing. I wrote in a notebook at the time and was holding onto it, and I said, well, I'm doing King Lear. And he said, oh, you have to look at the sources of that, and saw Gorboduc and all of that. And so I said, oh, yeah, that would be great. And so he wrote it in my notebook. Of course, I lost the notebook, or maybe it's somewhere in my archives, but I don't know. But he got off the train, and I continued on. And then I think when I went to the house, Bill said, oh, do you remember meeting Eugene before? And he said, no, not at all. He never remembered that event. So his friend Pierre Martiré was very excited by this notion that after I became the secretary for about 8 years, he always introduced me as, this is Eugene, who John Ashbery met but didn't remember. But now he's the secretary. So there you go.
That was charming. I like that. I didn't know that part of that story. So kind of preposterously, when I had published one book a long time ago, I was put on a panel with John Ashbery and Susan Sontag, moderated by Richard Howard, who, upon meeting me, said, you will have nothing to say on this panel. And I loved him for that and thought it was funny. And because I was 27 years old and hadn't done anything much at all in my life except read poetry and read books and write poetry, I was a nervous wreck to be on a panel with these very prominent, fabulous people I worshipped, basically, and or really admired. And so, of course, I wrote something because I could read what I wrote, since that's what I do mainly. And it was about, we were asked to talk about putting books together. So I'd put one together. And of course, Sontag and John and Richard were all wonderful and said fabulously beautiful things and funny things. And so I read my piece, and the audience took pity on me and acted like they loved me, which was, you know, I was relieved. So that's when we met. And then I saw him read a few times, but I didn't even talk to him at the readings that much. But he became friends with my husband, James Tate, and David and him, and they were good friends. And so I became part of getting to be with them often, and I loved it, and I feel real lucky that I still have David in my life and Eugene, so it's nice.
Sure, thank you.
Yeah, and I wrote something for this today because I'm still the same person who's very nervous about things. So it's very short, just a tiny little thing, so don't worry about it, but I was reading some of the book that's called They Knew What They Wanted, Poems and Collages. And I was looking at it again and reading there's an interview in it with John Yao. And in it, John Yao quotes John to John in asking a question. And this is what he quotes John saying. The fact that certain dots were so close together that they took up more space than the colored ground. The way the stripes in gingham went over and under each other to make the checks. The way the prickly flowers nudged each other. The way a flimsy dish towel displayed the fact it was starting to unravel. A little proud to be showing off how it was made. These things meant something. That they had been used and discarded, then rescued for the future use. That women had worn these dresses and aprons, worn them out, meanwhile caring for them, washing, ironing, mending, and finally choosing what to be saved, adds to their strange drama. I envied whoever had had charge of them and had gotten to know them intimately during their life cycle until they were faded and frayed. That person could understand their language. And I thought that was a really beautiful way of seeing into John's tender heart, you know, which is so apparent in all his work. So it goes without saying that Ashbery's influence is pervasive. His poems cannot stop glamoring us into open-minded awe. Can a voice made of words feel any more intimate than his? With his whispering intellect, questioning its very almost every assertion. Always saying, wait a second, there's something else. Always prepared to recognize a chance to turn another corner. There might be something there. John's writing is very, very good at making and recognizing something that's new. It's possible that what he touched, what he read, what he chose to bring into his life, what he surrounded himself with, whether walls or carpets, faces or chandeliers, words or books, his or others, music, pictures, or toy representations of what could amuse him. It is possible that the material world he charmed into being his own can help us feel his presence and make us feel as if we're getting to know something possibly he knew too, the fringe on the lampshade. So back to our purpose, and the focus of us being here today, to have the pleasure of seeing the carefully selected and thoughtfully arranged samples, thanks to Jeffrey Leppendorf, Flowchart's executive director, and Nina Boutiskaris, Flowchart's librarian and archivist. I view the materials surrounding an artist's life and life works sometimes as evidence of some kind, and often as powerfully eminent. Their source of being together is the same source that brings the poet's art together. It may have an altogether other mood or atmosphere, though probably not one so estranged as to be irrelevant. What one surrounds oneself with contributes to one's character, whether it's words, people, wallpaper, animals, china patterns, nostalgic relics, or paintings. So I was basically catering a house vacating party yesterday in Madison, Connecticut. And I was asking, somebody was telling an anecdote about, for the first time in his life, seeing a Stephen Crane original manuscript. And it is in an archive that allowed you to touch the pages. And he talked about how when he touched the pages, he was chilled to the bone. And there was another person sitting listening to the anecdote. And so I said, oh, so I want to ask you a kind of meta question about this, not just about what you just told us. But so what was it, do you think, made you chill to the bone over touching the original manuscript? And the man said, I don't know. Really, no, I can't say right now. And so I turned to the other person who I had just barely gotten to know for 2 days. But I knew he was skeptical. I knew he was not cynical, but difficult to please. And I could see that was hiding a really tender heart. And I said, so what about you? If you had touched a manuscript by somebody you really loved, would it leave you cold? And he said, yeah, it would leave me cold. And I thought, wow, there are two different kinds of people in the world. And in another way. And so I was kind of interested in that idea that for some people, they don't feel what you feel when you're surrounded by somebody's manuscripts, handwriting, their mind. And other people, like, really, it's kind of like water off a duck's back, you know? But it's, I assume that we're all in the tender-hearted category, but not because we're cynical. So thank you.
Well, they've told how we came into contact. Maybe I should tell about how
sure.
I met John.
Yeah.
Sure. I'll shorten the story. It was through a high school classmate of mine. I mean, someone I knew in high school. We didn't go to the same school, but we socialized in the same groups. And he was going to visit. I was already living in New York as a graduate student. And he was going, he had been in Albany and babysat our house while the whole family was away for my sister's wedding, which was where we live in the country in the Adirondacks. And everybody knew that this was taking place, and the house was filled with all of her wedding presents and everything. And so we had to have someone stay in the house. So he came and stayed in the house, and then we went to New York that following Monday, where he was going to visit me, stay with me for a couple of days in my apartment on West End, an apartment I shared with two other graduate students on West End Avenue, I think in the low 80s. It was a beautiful apartment. And my friend Dean wanted to see John. He had studied with John the previous summer at some place out in the Midwest, maybe Illinois or Indiana or somewhere. So he called up John and said he was in town, wanted to see him. John said, well, I'd love to see you, but the only night I have free is tonight, and I have to go to a small cocktail party, but I'm sure you and your friend, me, would be welcome. So we go trotting up to the Upper East Side to people we've never met before, knew nothing about, and it was a small cocktail party, probably 15 or 20 mm-hmm. people. And at some point, a lot of them had to go to the airport to meet somebody, and for some reason, my friend Dean went with them, leaving John and me outside of the apartment, standing on the sidewalk, having just met. And John said, well, you want to have some supper? And I, a poor, starving graduate student at Columbia, said, sure. And that was that.
So I know that you, I've read in some interviews with you that you weren't interested, very interested in poetry at first, and then what happened for you when you, what was it, when was it that you decided, okay, I think like this is, something's going to happen with John, I should pay attention to this, I should make this bibliography. What was it that made you realize that?
Well, it started out very simply. John at that point was starting to travel a little bit. He was being invited to give readings and things. And one day I got a call from him saying that, I don't know, someplace needed a bio quickly for PR purposes, and he told me where they were, and so I got and told me where to send it, and so I did. I looked at the bio, and I was appalled at how bad it was, and I thought, man, I could do a lot better than this, so I sent it off because they needed it, and I decided I was going to do John a proper bio, and I started piecing things together, and John had been out of the country for about 10 years when he lived in France, and so he wasn't aware of a lot of the things. He didn't participate in a lot of the things that the people who were here did, obviously. And he, in fact, didn't even know about a lot of the publications of his work. Mm. And so I started collecting that and gradually putting it together. And then I became aware that the Phoenix Bookshop in New York, Robert Wilson's place, which some of you know, was putting out short bibliographies, author bibliographies. And I knew Bob, and because I had bought stuff in there and everything, and he was a good friend, he was a friend of John's. And I said, if I do this bibliography, will you publish it? Sure. And so years went on, and it grew and it grew and it grew. And I showed it to Bob, said, I can't publish this. This is 300 pages worth of work. So I got Garland, which was at that point a major academic publisher, to publish it. And it came out, fortunately, just as John was winning the three prizes for self-portrait in A Convex Mirror. So I think it got a lot more attention than it normally would have as an author bibliography. Mm-hmm. So it was just coincidence. Mm-hmm. And then it got a good review in the TLS, and they reviewed three or four author bibliographies, and they ended with mine, and they hated the first three or four that they did, and they said, all of these guys should have used Kermani's bibliography as a model. So,
how did things change? How did life change with John after he won the Triple Crown for Self-Portrait?
Not that much. Mm. I mean, people were aware of who he was, at least. I mean, that was because he got a lot of publicity. And there's one funny story. You know, we went to a lot of receptions and cocktail parties and things like that, and there was always a new graduate student who was fawning over John and everything. And we were at one, and the next group included Susan Sontag and a bunch of other friends. And so this graduate student was saying, oh, John, you're the only person, you're the first person to ever win all three prizes for the same book. And Susan wheeled around and said, and we made sure nobody can ever do it again.
I want to just talk a little bit about this idea of created spaces, which is a term I think you coined. Is that true?
Well, it sort of evolved.
Okay.
Yeah. Part of it was Michaela Morissette, who worked for us, with us, John and me and Flowchart, at the very beginning.
Yes. Can you talk a little bit about that, about how you and maybe these people around you started to realize that the things that John arranged around him were significant to his work, you know, not just funny and interesting?
Sure.
Yeah, and from the others as well, maybe you have.
Well, I think I got involved starting in the early 80s with Olana and the private support group, which was then called Friends of Olana, which is now the Olana Partnership. And I rose up eventually to president and all of that. But Jim Ryan, the director at the time, became very good friends and loved our house in Hudson because the main stair hall reminded him of the Olana stair hall. And at one point, when the house was starting to come together by the mid-80s, Jim took me aside and said, you'd really better start paying attention to what John is doing here, because I'm pretty sure that this house is going to be seen as one of John's most fully realized creative projects. Mm-hmm. And so I took that to heart, because Jim Ryan was an excellent museum director and curator, and that's when I really started paying close attention. And eventually, things got cataloged and arranged, organized, and all of that. And
we have there's a QR code back here for the Ashbury's Nest, which is this incredible project where you can have a VR experience of the house, and there's commentary from David and John talking about the things in the house. We have some things from the house here, and others not, but there are a lot of items from the house, including those bells, I think, in the front, that you had by the door?
They were by the dining room door, and they summoned people to dinner.
Mm-hmm.
But they're Asian of some sort. I don't remember the exact provenance. And John loved those elephant hooks. I've got some in Albany, too. I think there was a set of four of them. And I don't know where he got them, but he loved these quirky things, mm-hmm, and made use of them. And so that's how that all got going.
Yeah. And you have both been in that Hudson house.
Oh, yeah.
What is your experience? Could you describe a little bit, maybe for people that don't know what exactly we're talking
about?
Well,
there's a huge Yale website, the Beinecke Library at Yale. If you just Google Ashbury House Yale, you can spend hours in it. Mm-hmm. It documents the whole house and many of the objects in it.
Yeah. You stayed in the house for a while, right?
Yes. We were trying to put together a house over on Tenbrook Lane, and Roseanne and I, you know, didn't have much of a place to stay So we were able to live with in John and David's house, and we had a wonderful time, especially with the movies, you know, which is something that we put together. Roseanne put together a catalog of movies that John had copied, and I just saw, you know, upstairs there's a whole bunch of the tapes in VHS format, because they were a great influence on his work. So, I mean, they're not technically part of a created space, but they're part of a domestic archive, mm-hmm. which is a term that David has been using, I think, to describe a created space. And the movies themselves, which is something that we can talk about later in terms of the collage, you know, we're part of the ritual of, you know, we used to come up from New York on Thursday after John completed his Newsweek article on Thursday, and then we would, you know, get in the car, come up and have dinner, and we'd usually start watching TV, so pretty much for the whole weekend. And of course, John was always writing down lines from the movies. I have something that'll illustrate that a little bit later.
But let's get into it now. You want to get it?
Sure.
Yeah,
yeah.
Go ahead.
This is a very interesting poem which came out in April Galleons, which was, I think, in the 90s. It's called The Snowball in Hell. Roseanne and I were watching with him Seventh Victim, which he's written on many, many, many times.
We have a short piece that he wrote about up there in the case, if anyone wants to read the whole thing in turn.
It has Tom Conway in it playing the psychiatrist, and there's a poet, and there's a whole group of devil worshippers and so on. And anyway, the poet was up in his garret, and it's in New York City, and looking out the window, and he said, "Oh, look at the sky and the stars, like a sword cutting the blue cloak of a prince." And John copied that down, and it wasn't too long afterwards that it appeared in A Snowball in Hell. And I'll just read the first paragraph. "In the beginning, there are those who don't quite fit in, but are somehow okay. And then some morning, there are places that suddenly seem wonderful. Weather and water seem wonderful, and the peaceful night sky that arrives in time to protect us, like a sword cutting the blue cloak of a prince." It really weaves it right in there. And I don't think anybody has done a major study of this, that people have found small lines. But at one time I was talking with him, and I said, "Oh, you know, you've really stolen lines from a lot of W.C. Fields movies." And I said, it was like, five of them that I had. "You did them from that one. He said, "Oh, yes, and there's actually others." And then he went into like four or five more. So that was another gold mine for him.
Well, it came out of everyday experience as well.
Yeah.
And I was told that at one period I would talk in my sleep, and I realized that John kept a pad and pencil on his nightstand and would write down what I said and use it. And then we used to watch a lot of the cooking shows on the, you know, the Create Channel or whatever it's on. And every once in a while you get some good one-liners out of those chefs. Martha Stewart once said, "Now we're going to toast your buns." And I said, "Pants on or pants off?" And at one point, one of those cooking shows had, you'd see the apprentices in the background and, you know, doing chores and stuff like that. And there was one very attractive young man who was there for a week or 10 days, and then all of a sudden he was gone. And John said, "What happened to Cutie Pie?" And I said, "Cutie Pie went bye-bye," and then within a week that was in a poem. "Cutie Pie went bye-bye." So it came from everywhere.
Yeah.
One of the things, talk about material culture created by one of your jobs was to collect all these little scraps of paper, mm-hmm. that were generated by his note-taking on goings on. And I know you used to do that in New York, in the New York apartment, there was one big drawer in his desk. You'd throw them all in, and then when he sat down to write, he'd pull them out one by one and decide what, you know, talking about collage. Did he do that in Hudson too?
Oh yeah, yeah. And then that took a that developed further that whole concept, because John would use a line in more than one poem, and when it came time to put a book together, he'd want the duplicates changed. And so to make life easier, I would note when he would write a poem, I'd come out the next morning and I'd go through the poem and look at the scraps on the desk, and the ones he had used, I would note on the back the date that he had used. I'd used
fantastic
December 10th, whatever, and so he wouldn't use it again, and so we could trace things back. Harvard has all those now, and so scholars will.
Bibliographer.
Well,
yeah.
Now they'll know right where it came from.
Yeah.
And another thing that got this going right after we set up Flowchart. John did a reading in April of 2001 out at Stanford University, where Marjorie Perloff was, of course, and another friend of ours, Nicholas Jenkins, a British scholar, is still on the faculty there, I think, and he's reviewed John and written very intelligently about John, and he took me aside and sort of lambasted me for not keeping up with the bibliography, and I said, but the bibliography came out as John won all those prizes. John became famous, and the stuff isn't obscure anymore because people pay attention to where it's published. And I said, I didn't see any need. He said, you don't understand how lazy these graduate students are. If it's not right on a plate in front of them, they'll go do something else. And so we had just started Flowchart, and that's when we really got going again with this idea of the Ashbury Resource Center. And we've dealt with some significant scholars from all over the place who have used this collection upstairs. And one in particular, Karen Rothman, who is John's biographer, said that she's found that collection to be absolutely amazing because it brings together stuff that you would never think of looking for. John's, that illustrates John's swath in the cultural world. I mean, the references that turn up, there was one of my favorite ones was a West Coast, probably a little weekly newspaper in some suburb of God knows where, endorsing candidates for the school board, which they all do, nothing unusual. And it goes through the list of the endorsement and everything. It ends with, as the poet John Ashbery says, quote, blah, 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 blah. And, I mean, it presumes that the writer knows who John Ashbery is. He assumes his readers know who John Ashbery is and that it will mean something to them. I mean, that's the kind of stuff you would never find in a scholarly catalog of anything. And well, it just amazes me that that influence is so pervasive.
Yeah. Well, you know, a little bit about that. Just like a bibliography collects, and yours especially collects in an unusual way,
yeah,
things that would not be thought to be put together. That's what poets do, and all mostly when somebody experiences a poem for the first time, if they didn't write it, and sometimes if they wrote it, you look at it and wonder, how did this all get together? You know, and you know it's the mind, but it wasn't an intentional thing necessarily, but you had to notice it. It's important that it was brought together in a way that is, to me, just beautiful. The first time I walked into the house, you all had been in the house for a while.
Yeah,
there had been
but
a lot of things.
It was far from finished.
It was not finished yet, but there was an incredible treasure of beautiful things to look at, and from carpets to things on walls to everything about it was so beautiful, and it was very moving to see it for the first time. It was pretty scary because it was so powerful, you know. So I love that, and then I love that I got to see it a lot more.
Yeah, and it was you know, once I began realizing what was happening with that house and how John was putting his whole creative being into it, that's when I realized I started buying my own houses. Because almost nothing in that house was mine.
Yeah.
Because it needed to be John's.
Yeah.
And I wasn't going to, you know.
Well, you know,
interfere.
One time Jim and I slept upstairs in the very attic room, sort of. Yeah. And we were both so excited because the blanket on the bed had J.A. sewn into it by his mother, I presume.
Probably when he went to Deerfield.
Sending to Deerfield.
Yeah.
And that was so sweet, just that it was still there. It's like those women who kept the, you reuse their aprons and their dish towels.
Sure.
Yeah, it's good.
Can you talk a little bit about some of these pieces that are on the wall, David,
and
everyone else? What are we looking at, and what's the significance? How did it show up in his work, or vice versa?
Well, let's see. Things that are directly related to John. The watercolor, black and white watercolor, the watercolor in black ink, I should say, that's matted in white there in the center of this right-hand section, that is a piece by Sam Messer, who's a fairly well-known artist. He's a contemporary of John Yao's, and I think a good friend of John Yao's. And that is three figures from left to right. The partial figure on the left is John Yao. The central figure is John Ashbery. And the figure on the right is Rachel Stella, the daughter of Frank Stella, who was John Yao's partner for many, many years. And the three of them are playing Scrabble.
Yep.
And there are stories with all of them. The portrait directly above to the left of the guy in the white shirt and the tie, that's by a good friend and artist named Joe Shannon, a Washington artist, and that's a portrait of Walter Hopps, who was a curator, I think, either at the Corcoran or the National Gallery, or maybe both. And then the reflection in the mirror behind is John Yao.
He's everywhere.
Yeah. The directly to the left of that big framed piece that's a section of John's poetry, that's by Larry Rivers. And that was a study for one of a series of paintings he did that was one of the early shows at the then-new Robert Miller Gallery in New York when it opened, I think, at 724 Fifth Avenue between 56th and 57th on Fifth. And he did two big series of paintings for that show. One was John Ashbery writing, and the background of all of those paintings was with John's poetry. And it was all lettered in very carefully, not by Larry, but by an assistant, I'm sure. And Larry was the bad boy in the New York art world, and he was just adored by these blue-haired dowagers from Park Avenue. They loved the bad boy image, so they went to his openings and things. And at that one, the two series that Larry showed were John Ashbery writing, many of them at a typewriter, and the lettering formed the background of the paintings, and the other was Larry's take on Rembrandt's Polish Rider, the guy on the horse. Mm-hmm. And I witnessed this directly, two of these dowagers waiting to leave the gallery, waiting for the elevator, and one says to the other, "Well, my dear, how did you like the Polish Rider paintings?" And the response was, "I didn't realize John Ashbery was Polish." So that's the story with that one. The little black oval one is a painting probably of something in Turkey that John's grandparents brought back from their European tour. And that always hung in their house, and then it always hung in our front hall in Hudson. The Rin Tin Tin poster, which is fairly infamous, relates to one of John's early plays, The Compromise. And John has described in interviews that play, and he says, "Well, I left pretty much the whole play there, except I took the dog out." And so he hung that in the stairwell as you came up the grand main staircase in the Hudson House and entered the big central hall on the second floor, and you were looking down the staircase to the back stairs that go down to the kitchen. And he hung that right there. It was the first thing you saw when you got to the second floor after this grand entrance. Rin Tin Tin.
That's great.
Yeah.
And I can't see a lot of what's over there. The snow boy and the little yellow, the guy in the yellow slicker, I forget what brand he was with. But John loved those. Those hung in our kitchen.
Mm-hmm. Was he Morton Salt for the little girl?
I don't think so.
I don't think so.
Oh, you need a biscuit.
You need a biscuit, yeah. Yes. And John had a couple of other pieces, a china thing with that decal on it, and he loved that little kid. Mm-hmm. And then over here, the big white, the white painting is an early Trevor Winkfield. We have a lot of Trevor Winkfields. He's a very close friend and a wonderful artist, and also scholar. He's an art historian, and he mm-hmm. writes very, very well about lots of things. Mm-hmm. And Trevor called us once. There was a big estate that was coming up for auction, and the guy had been, or the person had been, an art collector. And a lot of things didn't sell. I forget what the economic situation was, but we got a call from Trevor one day. The executor of that estate had taken these back to her place. I think it was in Kingston, but very near here. And Trevor said she wants to get rid of them. She doesn't know what to do with them because they didn't sell. And he said, if you contact her, and gave us the number, go over and see them, and I think you can get them for a very reasonable price. And so John and I hightailed it over there, and we each, she had two, and we each bought one on the spot because they're early and they're really good, and they're not, you don't see them on the market at all yeah. anymore. Which,
oh, yeah, talk about this little painting right here in the gold frame under the snow boy.
Oh, that's by, is it Edward Lear? Yes. Well, you remember the details of that better. John bought it, what, with Edward?
Tell us.
He was with Edward Gorey? Or?
I think that's true. Well, just for those who don't know, that Edward Lear, who wrote The Dong with a Luminous Nose, which is also the title of a Ashbery poem, which is right. a cento, that is yes. every line is from another poem. But and also, the one poem probably everyone knows is The Owl and the Pussycat. Right, so great nonsense poet, the best. Yeah. And Ashbery loved him, and I'm told loved that etching because it was hand-colored by Edward Lear.
Yeah, that hung in our library in Hudson.
I want to talk a little bit about John as an art writer before we end our hour. Just, David, maybe you can start us, and then everyone else can talk. But you said that at some point you decided Ashbery's art writing, which Ashbery viewed as strictly work for hire, was actually a key to understanding the poetry, because although Ashbery notoriously refused to explain his poems, many of the things he said about other people's work could be applied to his own. And you said if only people could see the same connections that he did, they would understand the poetry better. Can you talk a little bit about that, what you meant by that?
Well, that's why I included it all in the original bibliography. I was told not to bother with it. This is just work for hire. It's hack stuff and whatever. And I didn't see it that way. I thought it was very revealing about John's own work. And it's turned out that a lot of scholars now agree with me. And so I was glad I included it. As the resource center has grown, we've kept up with all of that. And some of it's been published now. Well, it was published years ago, reported sightings, a selection of it. And Jeffrey's done a book just a couple years ago that brought out other pieces that I wanted to have available to the public and that are really important for understanding John's own creative process. And so that's why I focused on that, and I think a lot of people now agree that it is a great insight into that.
I have something to read from the Selected Prose, which is a volume I put together with the help of David's bibliography. It would have been impossible without it, searching for everything through libraries and so on, because I had the details, and also using the online catalog, which was the continuation of that when Flowchart Foundation was set up. But there's a very interesting comment that he has about Bishop's poems, which then comes up again in his art writing about Jane Freilicher, and it's very much, I think, a reflection of what he's doing as well. The bishop comment was, this is John, this quality which one can only call thingness is with her throughout, sometimes shaping a whole poem, sometimes disappearing right after the beginning, sometimes appearing only at the end to add a decisive fillip. In over 2,000 illustrations and a complete concordance, a bishop poem, which is possibly her masterpiece, she plies continually between the steel-engraved vignettes of a gazetteer and the distressingly unclassifiable events of a real voyage. And then this is me commenting on this in the introduction. Many years later, in an essay dedicated to Jane Freilicher's painting, View Over Mekoc's Yellow Wall, from Voices in the Gallery, Writers on Art, Ashbery notes, quote, the painting sings a song of thingness, whether that of the swatch of nature sitting for its portrait, or the paint that's helping it to become itself, even as it casually poses for its own portrait. So over a period of more than 30 years, this notion of thingness appears twice. And I think that idea of, you know, putting things into the poem, arranging them, he also sees it in art. There's a bridge there somehow, which is very important.
Here's one other quote from Reported Sightings. That's a nice little one. John writes, when he's writing a piece about abstract expressionist painting, there was once a Mutt and Jeff strip in which Jeff had gone into business selling honey with a dead bee in each jar as proof of genuineness. And frantic brushwork is often the dead bee in abstract expressionist painting. Lie. Yeah, I love that.
I think we can end there. Thank you all so much
for talking
with us. And I hope everyone takes some time to poke around and look at all of the ways that all these different art forms and things combine to create Ashbery. So, yeah.